transform your life today. Welcome to Super Coach with Michael Neal.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Our topic for today is real love, and my guest is Dr. Greg Baer. He's the author of, gosh, how many books? We've got Real Love, Real Love in Dating, Real Love in Marriage, Real Love in Parenting, The Essentials of Real Love Workbook, The Essentials of Real Love Bible Workbook, Real Love for Wise Men and Women, The Power of Real Love, and Real Love and Freedom for the Soul, Eliminating the Chains of Victimhood, which I think is my favorite of the ones I've read so far. Without going too much further into it, welcome to the show, Greg.
Oh, a delight to be on with you, Michael.
Thank you. Now, I only came across your work in the last few months, but you've been doing it for a long time, is that right?
Yes, about probably 14 years, but only full-time, I'd say, for 8.
Right. And we're going to spend, in fact, the majority of our time talking about real love and its impact in all those areas that you've written about. But I would be love to sort of just introduce people a little bit to you, if you'd be willing to share some of your story and how you came to sort of discover the difference between real love and what you call imitation love, and how you got to this place where this is now what you spend your time doing.
Delighted to tell the story. I was a surgeon for 20 years, and I had spent a life impressing people with my accomplishments, which eventually became fairly empty and boring. But I was kind of like the quintessential smart kid, you know, the valedictorian, the top of my medical school class, that kind of thing. And I was very successful. And I discovered that despite all those successes, I just wasn't happy. There was this profound sense of dissatisfaction that I just couldn't put my finger on. Well, because I was a surgeon, you know, I had access to any number of drugs, and you know, I found I couldn't sleep at night. I was anxious a lot of the time, so I started taking sleeping pills, sedatives, eventually narcotics. I was shooting up narcotics every day for years, and this was while I was a surgeon, which should be fairly scary to anybody who's listening. And then I eventually got to the place where, in fact, I was sitting in the woods behind my house with a loaded Smith & Wesson to my head. So I was miserable, despite having what everybody calls success. I just couldn't have had much more, power, money, approval. But what was missing was that I was having to buy all that. No matter how much approval I had from people, I was buying it with my behavior. And so over a period of several years after my recovery from drug addiction, I discovered that what really makes people happy isn't any amount of approval or sex or food or power or whatever. What people really want more than anything else is to feel loved. And my problem was I didn't really know what love was. And so I've now, you know, spent years and years defining what real love is and discovered that I wasn't alone, that's what everybody wants, is to feel real love, or another word for that would be unconditional love.
So how did you find it? Was there a moment? Was there a mentor? Was there an aha experience?
It was a little slower than that. After my recovery from addiction, I gathered a bunch of friends, a bunch of buddies together, and we started meeting every week for several hours, and we were just determined to figure out what makes people happy. And so we tried every psychological trick, every technique that we'd ever heard of, nothing worked. And I started to notice that the times when we were really moved, the times when we were genuinely touched, would be like, you know, when I would tell you about a mistake that I made, a foolishness, a flaw, a weakness, and you would just look at me with just simple compassion and acceptance. I finally learned that what people really want is to feel loved unconditionally, and that was kind of a gradual process over probably a period of a year.
And so for you, once you saw that, I imagine there was a period of time where sort of the implications and implementation of that had to unfold, that you didn't just go, oh, I get it, it's about unconditional love, great, life's done.
You're a genius. It unfolded over a period of, until today. It just keeps unfolding. And so as I was learning these principles, I started to write them down, and I wrote one book and then two, and then, you know, then we started to do some seminars because I was just eager to share this with other people. And, you know, that's turned into, hundreds of seminars and 16 books. And as I can see how it applies to, you know, different areas of life, one of the latest was the Real Love and Freedom for the Soul, which is about victimhood, that you said was your favorite, which I was amused at because that's my favorite.
Great minds.
It applies to everything, Michael. When people don't have enough unconditional love in their lives, when they don't feel loved for no reason without having to earn it with their behavior or how they look or how smart they are, when they don't have enough of that, which is as essential as air or water, it creates a pain in them that they will react to, not might. I mean, the pain is as big as the Grand Canyon. And so then what we do is we reach out for anything that will temporarily make us feel better. And that is when, in our pain, we reach out and use anger, food, drugs, sex, power, shopping, driving fast, whatever it is. And, of course, all those things only last for brief moments. We feel good for a second, but then we have to reach out and we have to do it again. And we're left with the same emptiness until we discover unconditional acceptance.
Now, I'm listening. I've heard the phrase unconditional love before. I go, yeah, that sounds lovely, but where do I even begin?
It's pretty easy. You know, all of our lives we've been trained to earn it, and what I mean by unconditional love is love, frankly, only counts when you love me, not when I'm doing good. If you love me because I've done something that you like, well, frankly, that's just worthless, because now we're just kind of trading, just as though we were paying each other for approval, power, acceptance, whatever. Unconditional love happens when I tell you about my stupidness, my flaws, my mistakes, and you completely accept me. My definition of real love is when I care about your happiness without any concern for myself. And you know that, Michael, most of us from the time we were little kids have never seen unconditional love. Because think about what happened when we were little kids and we got good grades, we were kind to our brothers and sisters, we had clean rooms. Well, then, you know, people would pat us on the head and they would say, "Oh, Michael, oh, you're such a good boy." Now, we love that. But we also saw what happened the instant we screwed up. You spill milk across the living room table, dining room table. You yell at your brother. You don't have a clean room. Immediately, people scowl. They frown. Their tone of voice changes. We hear them sigh. And every time we hear those expressions, what we hear is, "I don't love you." So love only really counts when we're loved while we're making mistakes, being stupid, being flawed, and that is a life-changing experience. So you asked, how do you create it? Simple. I just did it with you. You asked me to tell the story of my life, and I said, "Oh, man, I was a drug addict. My life was a mess." And as you feel that just sense of compassion and acceptance for me, frankly, I can feel it clear from here. Even though we're 1,000 miles apart, I can feel your acceptance. That is real love.
And I think the amazing thing, because I've only, when I've thought about unconditional love, and I've written about unconditional love in my own way before, and one of the expressions that I first heard that made sense of it to me was from the Christian author Philip Yancey, who wrote, "Unconditional love is realizing that there is nothing you can do that will make God love you any more, and there is nothing you can do that will make God love you any less."
You just nailed it. That's what it's all about. When I'm with my wife, for example, I can screw up in any number of ways, and her expression never changes. That's unconditional love. Most people believe that that can only come from God, but you know, we can actually learn to do that as human beings, because I've now seen it, tens of thousands of times. And one of the reasons, since you brought that subject into here, is one of the reasons that people have a difficult relationship with God is because, well, think about it. What are the two words that we use to describe God most? First is, God is love. I mean, that's kind of the essence of most of the major religions on the planet. And if all we have ever experienced is that kind of love that is traded, it's transient, it comes and goes, it can be taken from us in a minute, and then you tell somebody, okay, God is love, and they're thinking, now they don't do this consciously, but they think, God is more of that kind of love I've known all my life. They don't want any more to do with that.
Sure, you've got to behave in the right way, and then you'll be beloved, and if you behave in the wrong way, you go to hell.
You've got it. And the other word we use to describe him is what? Father. Well, you know, most of us don't want a bigger version of the one that we've already got. And so when people hear that God is love and God is Father, they're going, you know, thanks, but I'll pass. Once people understand real love, because I've now seen this thousands of times, as they feel unconditional love from you or from me, then they begin to say to themselves, mostly unconsciously, but later intentionally, you know, if God is more of that, I can conceive of a loving God. It's a wonderful thing to see.
So I don't want to go too far away from a comment you made just a minute ago about your wife and you know, her being able to be with you and whatever you do, her being able to just accept it unconditionally. Because, I often trade places with my listeners and kind of go, where can we get your wife? Does she have a sister?
And, you know, this is the neat thing. My relationship with my wife is something that didn't just come as like a gift. It didn't just drop out of the sky. It's something that we developed. And so when people say to me, and I've now counseled thousands of couples, they say to me, oh, if only my wife could be more like that. Oh, it's not about her. It's about you. It's not about changing your wife. The reason you're having a difficult relationship is almost always because you don't know what unconditional love is. And so what you do is you trade with your wife what I call imitation love, which is anything that's not real love. Oh, sex, power, money, whatever it is. And because you establish that modicum of trading, that mode of trading, she'll trade with you. If you learn what unconditional love is, first to find it, and usually from somebody else, then you can bring that back to your partner, and she will drink it up. That's what Donna and I, my wife and I, have learned to do with each other, to the point now that my relationship isn't just better than anything I've ever seen. It's better than anything I even thought possible. And I'm here to tell everybody who's listening, we can learn to love unconditionally, and it will revolutionize our marriages, our way of parenting, the way we function in business, just literally everything.
Okay, so I'm listening, and I'm kind of going, all right, yeah. Now, I want to do this.
Okay.
So I want to bring this into my marriage. I want to bring this into my relationship with my kids. I want to bring this into my relationship with my parents.
Uh-huh.
Where do I begin?
I would recommend that people start with just reading the book Real Love, or if you're in marriage, Real Love in Marriage, or you can go to the website, reallove.com. There's, oh my goodness, hundreds of hours of material that will teach you. But all that does is kind of give you the outline, kind of like what real love looks like, at least gives you the language. But actually creating it is a very tender, intimate thing. So, for example, when somebody comes to me and they say, let me tell you about my marriage. My wife does blah, 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 blah. And I say, okay, so we've got that your wife does not know how to unconditionally love you. We're done with that. We're done talking about her. Now, how do you respond to that? And as they describe their behavior to me, I help them see how, and it's a very gentle, although very direct process, that inevitably, invariably, this man who's talking to me is being very unloving toward his wife. And so I show him exactly how. Do you see how this is selfish and this is unkind and this is angry? And do you see how many times in a day you say to your wife, without meaning to, I don't love you? Now, here's the transformative moment. What I tell him is, if I were talking to you, for example, and you were saying this, even though you're being selfish, I completely understand why. You're only doing that because you've never been a recipient of real love. You've never been trained in being unconditionally loving. And so this is all you have to offer. And I'm here to tell you I accept you completely like this. Now, if you want to change it, I can give you some ways that we can change it. But the transformative moment is just you feeling. It's not an intellectual process. Feeling my love for you as you are being a horse's butt, for example, as you're being selfish, as you're being a jerk, that's what changes you. Because as you feel loved by me, and I'm just one mortal fool, but as you feel loved by me and by others, as you are truthful, you now have an incalculably powerful characteristic, which is loving, unconditional loving, that you can then take back to your wife. That's what transforms these relationships and lives.
One of the real revelations to me, because there's something about this particular take, the clarity that you've brought to this distinction around unconditional versus conditional, real love versus imitation love that I've found does keep opening up new vistas, new ways of seeing. I have a friend, a very good friend, who, well, I live in Hollywood, so it's not that unusual. You know, he presents a different image to the public than he has in private.
Yeah.
And I'd never thought of it this way before, but we were talking to him, my best friend and I, recently, and it just suddenly dawned on me, gosh, one of the side effects of this that I've never thought of before is he can never really feel loved. Because he never could know, in the same way as people go, when you inherit money, well, do they love me? Do they love my money? That with him, he will never know whether or not somebody actually loves him or they love his story.
You are so insightful. That is like at the crux of real love. As soon, Michael, the instant that I pretend with you to be anything other than what I am, to win your approval, the disaster is not if you don't accept me. The disaster is when you do. Because now what you're doing is you're loving not me, you're loving some false creation that I've put out for you to accept, and now I am absolutely doomed. The instant that I'm lying in any way, I can never feel unconditionally loved. Now, people will say, well, I don't lie. Oh, do you know that most of us lie all day long? There was a study done by Boston University just recently that showed that the average person lies every minute that they're actually speaking, 3 to 5 times a minute. That's how much we try to create this false persona for people to like. The disaster is that as soon as I do that, I can never feel unconditionally loved because I've created the condition by lying.
So one of the things you talk about is, and you talk about it in a very gradual, gentle way, but is beginning to tell the truth.
Yes. In fact, that is the hardest thing for people to do. I have now had as clients Medal of Honor winners, Silver Star winners, war heroes, firemen who've gone into buildings, and these are great, big, tough men. And the very hardest thing they tell me that they've ever done is be completely honest about themselves. Oh, it scares them to death. Now, I'm not recommending that people run out and tell all the truth about themselves all at once. Well, that'd just be way too frightening, and people couldn't handle it. I mean, little things, like I was just doing with you, pretending that you were the, you know, angry husband at the wife. I just say, so, tell me the truth here. Were you loving with your wife yesterday? We're not talking about a whole life pattern. No, just yesterday. And, of course, the answer usually is, well, but she, oh, I know. We'll take her out later and stab her in the leg with a fork. So we got it. She made a mistake. But she's irrelevant here. Were you loving? And just gently, I take him to the place where he looks at me, usually with tears in his eyes, and says, I wasn't loving. I was selfish. I was thinking only of myself. And when I'm angry at her, what she hears is, I don't love you. That's an example of truth-telling about just one event. And then when he can see in my face that I care about him, as he's being, well, considerably less than flattering, he begins to get a sense of what a moment of unconditional love is. And once people taste that unconditional love, their life can never be the same. So it's amazing, and it starts with telling the truth.
So that also raises another thing that you talk about that I had never thought about in this way, but I found fascinating, is that when you're frustrated or angry, you're wrong.
And, you know, when I stand in front of an audience of 1,000 people and I say, every time you're angry or disappointed or frustrated, you're wrong. You can see, 90% of the audience look at me with daggers in their eyes going, how dare you tell me that? And all I mean by that is this. Our whole reason to be, our reason to exist is to be happy, genuinely happy. Well, let's see. How do we get to happy? We feel loved when we are feeling loved and when we're being unconditionally loving. Well, this suddenly makes ethics easy, because then if our whole reason is to be happy, then anything that contributes to feeling loved, loving, and happy would be right, wouldn't it? This is simple. Mm-hmm. Just as obviously, anything that detracts from feeling loved, loving, and happy would therefore be wrong. I don't mean wrong like we're going to send you to hell. I don't mean you're evil. I mean wrong like doesn't work. Wrong like 2 plus 2 equals 5 is wrong. Wrong like if you get a flat tire, replacing it with the kitchen sink would be wrong. This doesn't work. So think, and I say this to entire audiences, you give me a single example of a time that you were angry and genuinely happy. Nobody can. Well, let's see. Then if anger doesn't make you happy, anger would be wrong. And let me tell you, I have never succeeded in continuing in being angry when I can remember that. When I can say to myself, Greg, if you're being angry, you are being wrong. Now, that doesn't make the other person right. They can be wrong, too, but I'm not here to change them. I'm here to change me. And if I'm wrong when I'm angry and I can simply realize that, oh, I can't keep it up, Michael, I have to stop it. I feel foolish.
There is this thing that I'm aware of in myself. I see all around me, but it's the justified anger. It's never, you know, it's the almost actually, you can go one beyond justified anger to righteous anger.
I hear this every day that I talk to people because they say, well, my wife did blank. And I say, well, so were you angry? Then you were wrong. But she, there's always a but. Hey, I get that. She's wrong too. But there's nothing that justifies your own misery and spreading it to the rest of the planet. Now, I'm not telling you you should do anything. Sometimes people say, well, you're telling me I shouldn't be angry. Oh, no, honey, I'll never tell you you shouldn't do nothing. If you want to be angry, keep it up. And then send me an email if that ever makes you happy. So you want to keep that up? Go for it. But there's no justification that in the end, when you're miserable, will suffice, will it? And so I leave it to them to decide, and I haven't had a single person, when it's explained sufficiently, who says, well, I think I'll be angry and miserable. It just doesn't work, Michael.
And I love your metaphor around anger of the person in the swimming pool. Can you share that?
I'd be happy to. This has just been so useful for me personally, and since, you know, hundreds of thousands of others have found it useful, I use it repeatedly. And that is, you know, imagine that you and I are having lunch together by the side of a pool. And we're in the Bahamas. The breeze is perfect. The food is perfect. The music. We're just having a great time. But then you notice that there's somebody in the pool next to you who's splashing your shoes, then your ankles and your pants or dress or whatever you're wearing. And you're thinking, this is not part of my perfect day. Now, you can't see who is splashing you because there's a deck chair between you and the guy in the pool. But eventually, you've had it because he keeps it up. You stand up to look over the deck chair to say something to this, well, idiot who's splashing you. And you see that the guy in the pool is drowning. Well, in that second, could you possibly continue to be angry at him? Well, obviously, no. I mean, how could you be angry at somebody who's drowning? Because now you know that he was splashing you only to save his own life, to keep his own head above water. Well, and what would you feel after that? Immediately, you'd feel a desire to help him. So in 1 second, you just went from angry to not angry to caring about his happiness. And in fact, it would be unconditional because you wouldn't walk up to him and say, well, $20, I'll help you out of the pool. So anger to unconditional happiness in 1 second. Can we do that in real life? Oh, heck yeah, we can. Think about every person in your life who's ever been inconvenient, annoying, frustrating, whatever. Every one of those people is reacting to emptiness and fear in their lives. In other words, a lack of real love, which is just as indispensable to us spiritually and emotionally as air is for a drowning person.
And when we come back after the break, I want to pick up on that and the idea of getting and protecting behaviors. But I also, after the break, want to really talk about the idea of real love in the workplace and its relevance there. So we are talking with Dr. Greg Baer. His website is www.reallove.com. And we will be back with much more right after this break. Bye-bye for now.
Hit it!
strategies for real change. This is Supercoach with Michael Neal.
We are back. We're talking about real love, and we're talking with the author of the book Real Love and Real Love in the Workplace and Real Love in Parenting, Dr. Greg Baer. Greg, just before the break, we were talking about how quickly anger can turn to just an unconditional service place by when we see that somebody there's an old poem by a British poet the title of which was not waving but drowning. And it's that idea that when we see that what the behavior that we're starting to react about isn't actually personal to us, it is in fact an attempt from them at protecting themselves or getting real love. And you talk about these as getting and protecting behaviors.
Yeah. Yeah. Continue. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. So really, it's just if you can just share with people what that is so that they can begin to recognize what it looks like in real life when someone is drowning.
So far, in my experience, every time somebody has talked to me about their anger and I ask them, why are you angry? The next word out of their mouth is he, she, or they. We blame our anger on somebody else. And it's due to a complete misperception. Because as I talk to them, I realize that the reason that these people are angry is because they believe that the other person is doing something to them or is failing to do something for them. And it turns out it's not nearly that personal. Anytime somebody is behaving badly, anytime somebody is attacking me, lying to me, withdrawing from me, failing to do what I want, invariably that person is just drowning themselves. They're barely surviving. They're coping with life. You know what? I'm not that important. It turns out I'm not the center of the universe, which is what essentially I'm claiming when I become angry that somebody didn't do something for me. So when I can look at somebody who's behaving badly and realize, you're kidding, they're just drowning. In that moment, my anger vanishes and my concern becomes then, well, what can I do for you? So for example, you know, I'm at a seminar. And in the middle of the seminar, a man stands up and says, you are just full of it. I don't believe any of this. I mean, he was just, he was on fire. Now, I could have been offended by that. I could have said, well, gosh, he doesn't like me. I don't have anything to do with this. This man has been alive for 40 years before he met me in this moment. And so all I said was, well, of course you don't understand this. Of course you don't accept this or believe in this. You've never seen unconditional love in your entire life. Now, as I'm speaking, this is a big man, 6'5", 250 pounds. I walked from where I was. I walked out into the audience, got closer and closer to him, and I just reached out and touched him on the shoulder. And I said, all of your life, when you've been angry, you've used it to protect yourself. And unfortunately, it has kept people away from you. And this great big man in front of everybody just dissolved into a puddle of tears. In his whole life, I talked to him later, he had never had the experience of being angry and then having somebody love him. Now notice, I didn't kiss him. I didn't say, oh, I love you. All I did was reach out and touch him and say, I understand. And he just wept. Oh, and I see this everywhere I go. That's all we want, Michael. And while we're being angry, of course, nobody sees that we're drowning. All I did was see that. It wasn't a trick. It's not a technique. It's genuinely seeing and understanding and accepting him. And it just dissolves all those barriers that we've struggled with for a lifetime.
And I think that's, I think that's so much a key to what enables, I'll speak for me, when I've looked at things through these filters, when I've looked at it in terms of, you know, am I being loving here, or am I playing some sort of approval game on one side or the other? I find it so useful to be able to just see that it is impersonal. The metaphor I always loved, Don Miguel Ruiz wrote a wonderful book called The Mastery of Love. And he uses the metaphor of, imagine being in a place where everyone had a terrible skin disease. And just, it was so painful that if you even brushed up against them, they would be in incredible pain, and it would be almost natural for them to blame you and to get angry with you if you brushed up against them. Yeah. But it wasn't you that caused their pain. It was the wound that hadn't been healed, and to translate it the rest of the way into the metaphor that you use, it's the places that haven't been loved with real love, that haven't experienced the real love that can allow those wounds to be there and then to heal. Or another story, actually, this might be a nice time if you're willing to share it, the story that you tell of the wart king.
That's the story that started all this off. This is a story, you know, about a king who was, you know, wealthy and powerful and, well, obviously had the entire kingdom. But when he was a child, he was born with warts all over his face. And, of course, you know how kind other children can be. And so they made fun of him, and he felt ashamed and actually issued a decree that if anybody made fun of his warts, they'd be killed. Well, that helps, but still he realizes that he's not being accepted. And so, you know, he spent all of his time alone in his room, and he was miserable and lonely. He heard about a wise man on top of a nearby mountain. And so, hoping that he could get some help there, he walked up to the top of the mountain. Now, at home, of course, he kept a bag over his head whenever he went out to be seen in public because he was ashamed of himself. But he took the bag off his head, walked up to the top of the mountain, found the wise man sitting under a tree, and he said, "I've come for your help." Well, the wise man looked at him, you know, thoughtfully for a moment and said, "You have warts all over your face," which was not what the king had come to hear. And he was furious. He said, "I don't," and put the bag back over his head. And the wise man said, "Well, yeah, you do." He was furious. The king said, "I'll have you killed." "Well, you know, then call your guards." Well, the king was ashamed. He'd never run into anybody quite like this. And so he began to run down the mountain away from the wise man, which is tough with a bag over your head. And so eventually he fell down a steep slope and into a lake where he began to drown. The wise man jumped in, pulled him out. The king took the bag off his head and, you know, looked at the wise man and said, you're laughing at me." "No, I'm not laughing." And he said, "Well, the boys in the village laughed at me and my father laughed at me." The wise man said, "Well, I'm not the boys in the village and I'm not your father." And for the first time in his life, the king felt some measure of acceptance. In fact, he looked at his reflection in the still surface of the lake and said, I really do have a lot of warts, don't I?" The wise man said, "Yeah, you really do." And the king said, "Well, you know, but when I'm here with you, I think I'll leave the bag off my head." And he did. And the wise man said, "Well, you know, when you go home, you might consider leaving the bag here, seeing what happens." He said, "Well, but some people will make fun of me." And the wise man wisely said, "Yes, some people will. But if you leave the bag off your head, you will find some people who won't." And the king went home without the bag. He did run into a few people who laughed at him, but he also discovered some people who accepted him completely with his warts. And he was happy for the rest of his life. We are the king with the warts. We hide our warts, our flaws, our mistakes all of our lives, and in the process, we remain alone. We make it, as you pointed out, well, earlier, we make it impossible to feel unconditionally loved the instant we hide our flaws.
And I think that is really the essence of unconditional love. It's unconditional.
Yes.
the whole point is that there are all these areas. And I found for myself in parenting that as I've begun to bring over the years a more and more unconditionally loving approach to my parenting, that at first what it seems to bring up is all the things that really need love, all the behaviors that are really difficult for me to deal with.
Yes.
But then as those come up and I'm able to incorporate them and love them as well, as much in the same way as everything else, there comes a point remarkably quickly with my children afterwards where our relationship just went to an entirely new level. And something I really loved in your notion of real love and parenting, and forgive me if I've oversimplified this, but what I took away from it was just the notion that really as a parent, you have two jobs, which is to love and to teach.
You say that brilliantly. And in fact, in the parenting book, I distill those and recommend that people actually make that one word, that we always with our children love and teach. As soon as we separate the two, the child is doomed. if we simply teach a child, here are the things you need to do, here's what's wrong with you, especially if there's any impatience, all the child hears is, I don't love you. If there's anybody listening who doubts that, go home, pick a child, any child, express any disappointment or irritation, and watch the child's face. It is devastating. It's also devastating if we simply love, or shall I say, coddle, or we're permissive with a child, and we don't have teaching accompany that. If we put them together, we're constantly unconditionally loving, and we teach them at the same time, I'm telling you, children will follow you to hell and back. But the instant we're impatient, we just gut them. They can't hear a thing we say.
And now, I'm curious about this, because I'm just genuinely curious about your experience. In a marriage, is it just love, or do you get to love and teach too?
You do get to love and teach. But let me tell you, you better try loving about 30 times before you try any teaching. Because most of the time that I see a flaw in my wife and I say, I think she should, it is almost every time something I need to change. Now, occasionally I do teach, but teaching with a spouse is so different from what most people have seen that they can't even imagine it till they hear it. For example, let's say that my wife is doing something in her approach with, one of our children that has caused some, say, conflict between them. Then I might say to her, you know, Donna, I've noticed over the last, 6 or 8 times that you have spoken to Rachel, one of our children, that you just haven't looked happy afterward. Now, you don't have to change a single thing about you. And this is critical. I'm not asking you to change. I've just noticed that you don't look happy. And if you're not happy, that concerns me. So I wonder if there's something about your interaction with her that you want to talk about so that you can be happier. Oh, Michael, when you present it in that way, she'll tell you anything. And then you can offer some suggestions. Whereas if we do what we usually do, which is, Donna, I don't like it when you talk to Rachel that way. Oh, that's just doomed to failure before you open your mouth.
So one thing, and we're really giving, I just want to explain, we're distilling. And in a way, there's a real value to this. We're distilling 14 years of work into a one-hour radio show, and I really want to encourage you, go to www.reallove.com. And Greg may have a different opinion, but I would say if you ordered one thing off the website, get either the DVDs or the CDs, the 6-CD DVD set. Because for me, Greg, where I really got it is in watching you interact with people in the audience.
Your insight just makes me laugh, because as you read a thing, it's so cold. Whereas if you watch the 6 DVDs, the Essentials of Real Love, you get to see it in action, because real love is a feeling. It's a power. It's not just a concept. If it's a concept, it's just another trick. And what you'll see in the DVDs is you get to watch me interacting with people in a way that most people haven't seen. I talk for, like 4 of the DVDs, and then the last 2, I work with people one-on-one in front of the audience. And you'll see that it is not a technique. It's not a trick. As people, there's one lady that I worked with, for example. She and her husband were about to divorce. And as I just love her, just accept her, she just dissolved. The anger, the fear just go away in the presence of real love. And then she has some of that essence, some of that quality that she can take back to her husband. Now, I want to emphasize that there's nothing special about me loving them. It's the power of love. It's not about me. It's about the unconditional love that transforms them.
So let me before we run out of time, because there's so many places we could go, I really do want to go to the notion of real love in the workplace, because to me, when I work with people, even people who really are not only capable but driven to bring real love into their relationships with their spouses, with their partners, with their children, can't even conceive of the idea that this is something that you would also do at work.
No, most people really can't. And yet, you know, as we've discussed, real love is the thing that people have to have in order to be happy, just like air or water. And as I teach, you know, rooms full of CEOs and business owners, I tell them, can you possibly imagine that need to feel unconditionally loved, somehow vanishes as they clock in or vanishes as they walk through the front door of their workplace. The people in the workplace need to feel unconditionally loved still more than anything else. They've done innumerable studies, and you know them, that say, you know, that you can get people to a workplace by giving them enough money, but you'll never keep them there because they must feel loved. Now, some people say, well, how can a boss unconditionally love an employee? I mean, we're not talking about hugging and kissing them. No, we're talking about genuinely being concerned about their happiness. And the entire book, Real Love in the Workplace, gives you 100 examples of doing that. But like, for example, as an employee screws up, what we tend to do is become annoyed by that. You know, Michael, you have to stop doing this. No, a loving boss says, okay, so what's going on here with you? What's going on either in your life? What's going on with your job that is making it so that the goal we've set is not being reached? How can I, as your mentor, your teacher, somebody who cares about you, how can I help you reach that goal? When you hear me talk to you like that, you're going to listen to every word I have to say and usually pour out your heart about what's going on, as opposed to if I'm annoyed or impatient, you will just shut down or defend yourself, both of which lead to, and this is the important thing that employers need to understand, lead to not only you disconnecting from me, but now you will become unproductive in the workplace. You will defend yourself. You'll become angry. These are the people who gossip. These are the bullies. And that costs money in the workplace. What I'm saying in short is real love leads to productivity and profits in the workplace. And the absence of it will literally kill your business.
And one of the things that I've noticed, even in the short time that I've begun playing with it as a deliberate concept, is just noticing the difference in how the people who work with me react when I don't bring anger and disappointment to our exchanges, but I do to the best of my ability, which is somewhat limited. But I do bring an element of and just a tone of, okay, we are still working towards a goal, we are still working towards a result, and what can I do to support us creating this result? And it does. It's a completely different experience.
Powerfully insightful. Now, see, what you just did was an example of truth-telling. You describe how there have been occasions when you have not been loving and when it's had a negative result. You just said, almost parenthetically, but importantly, you said, my ability to be unconditionally loving is limited. Oh, I could just kiss you on the neck. That's exactly what I mean by truth-telling. You didn't spill your entire guts, you know, lie on a couch and do psychoanalysis. You just said, hey, I screw up. My ability to love is... That is so endearing that people will just flock to you. I just got through working with a CEO, and, you know, he and his wife had been having marital difficulties, and, you know, and I talked to them and taught them what love is. They learned to be more loving to each other, and then within 3 weeks, he goes back to... I was at his place of business, and his employees are saying, wow, the guy has changed. As we feel unconditionally loved and as we learn to be loving toward anybody, it transfers to everybody else. It's a concept that's universally applicable.
So here's the thing. We've got a few minutes left, and if I've been listening, and I think it would be very, very difficult to have listened this far into the show and not have gotten a taste of this, a flavor for it. What are the 1, 2, 3 things? I absolutely go to the website, absolutely read the books. But if I want to begin today, just seeing what I can do to bring more real love into my life, into my marriage, maybe even just with myself, where do I start?
If you want to do an experiment in real love, it's pretty easy to do. Now, I'm not suggesting you do it with anybody, but pick somebody that, you know, knows you at least a little bit. You could try it with your wife. You could try it with at work. But this is an experiment that will get you a taste of real love almost every time and usually immediately. As you're talking with somebody about any kind of, conflict, any kind of stress, any kind of anxiety between you, think about any way that you could have been wrong. Sure, the other person may be wrong. I get that. That's irrelevant. But think about some way and then say to that person, you know, I was wrong. Let me tell you the mistake that I made. That I was wrong to do that or wrong to feel that or wrong to react in that way. That's all you have to say. Those magic words, I was wrong, are transformative. Because now what you've done is you've put down all the swords, all the weapons, all the walls, and said, here's the truth about me. And the reactions you get will stun you.
I actually had a chance to practice this last week. I might have just gently bumped into the bumper of the car in front of me in traffic. And I did. I just thought about it. I thought, well, that was my fault. I got out of the car with my insurance card in hand. And I just, when he came out, I just said, I'm so sorry. That was all me. My bad. What do you need? And it was, you could just see, like, all this, he was ready for a fight.
Yes.
And he even checked back in once. Like, he was fine. And then about 2 minutes in, he said, when I call later, is this all going to be different? And I was like, no, it really was just my mistake. Uh-huh. And it was, he actually called later and we chatted a bit on the drive home. And it was an extraordinary experience. It's not when I have a lot of experience of it being the other way, but I can easily imagine that that's not the standard experience of what happens after a traffic accident.
Oh, no. No, and I do this everywhere I go. Now, I forget sometimes, and that's when I'm a horse's butt and I feel bad and I introduce unhappiness into my life, but that's my choice. But I do this everywhere I go. When I'm in a discussion with somebody and they're trying to heap all the blame on me, and I just say, you're right about that. I was wrong. And I discover that not only does it create an opportunity for them to unconditionally accept me, which is just melting, not just for me, it gives them the chance, this is critical, to be loving, and that transforms them. Then, as they feel safe, because I just told the truth about me, oh, I'd say 70% of the time or so, the other person will say, no, I was wrong too. Now, that's not my goal. If I say I'm wrong so the other person will, now I'm just manipulating them. I'm just saying that's often a natural result of being honest.
So this, there might not even be time to go into this. We've got about 2.5 minutes left, but I'd just love a quick hit, if you've got one, on can you give real love to yourself?
Oh, that's a great question. And I hear that everywhere. It's a very common self-help mantra, you know, love yourself. And in my experience, no, absolutely not. Imagine that you are starving to death and dying of thirst in the middle of the desert, and I come up to you and I say, Michael, well, just feed yourself, fool. You'd look at me with incredulity and say, well, with what? If I could have, I would have. The reason people don't feed themselves when they're starving is they don't have it to give. And I've talked to now thousands of people who have said, I have tried to love myself. And I say, well, of course you have, but it doesn't work, does it? No. If you've never experienced unconditional love from another person, how would you give it to yourself? You can't give what you ain't got. Now, the cool thing is, you don't have to. All you have to do, that's the beauty of the simplicity, is simply tell the truth about yourself. You will, not might, find somebody who can unconditionally love you, and now that you have it, you give it to another. So I like to give the picture that real love is an infinite river. There's no lack of it. And as we tell the truth, we just reach our hand out and dip into it. Then we pass it on to others. And in the act of it passing through us, it actually magnifies. But there's no place where you have to be out in the desert alone and drill a well for yourself.
We're gonna finish on that. Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Greg Baer. You can learn a lot more at www.reallove.com. Greg, it has been a delight. I'm glad we finally got to connect, and I look forward to future conversations on and off the air. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Kyle in the studio. We will be back with another show next week. Until then, have fun, learn heaps, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye for now.